You and I back together Tuesday, September 14th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor Bill Dunlop joining us at the bottom of the 3 o'clock hour to talk about the constitutional law issues surrounding vaccine mandates, both from the White House and possibly on a state level as well. Author Adam Cott joined us in the 4 o'clock hour. He was between jobs. He's a writer, so he took a job working at a supermarket in an upscale Denver, Colorado suburb a couple of years ago, and he, in a brand new book, through a fictional character, talks about what he saw among regular customers once the coronavirus pandemic set in. And we thank you for hanging out with us, and we'll be back to open phones a little later in the hour. But when we do, like Mr. Big Voice said there, and the guy still never takes a day off, he's an amazing employee. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Last week, when President Biden floated a mandate and vaccination mandates for federal level workers, for contractors, and saying that federal regulators would push state level individual employers with X amount of employees or more, all of these to get more people vaccinated, you got the immediate hue and cry about this can't be right, this is illegal, this is unconstitutional. Well, are these things actually illegal or unconstitutional or not? A guy that we often call on in situations like this, Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor Bill Dunlap, is back with us. Bill, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Just fine here, despite all the pandemic.
Yeah, well, you're hanging in, Bill, which is good. So give me your thoughts on this. You hear this immediate hue and cry about, well, the president can't do this and Congress can't do that. Bill, you didn't get your law degree from YouTube or Facebook. You actually know what you're talking about. So give me an overview here as to what you heard Mr. Biden say last week.
Yeah, before we go any further, could you tell my students that about knowing what I'm talking about?
Bill, invite
me. That would be a big push.
Bill, just name the day. I'll be happy to go into one of your classes and tell them. Sure.
Great.
So what did you think?
I think that the president has the authority to do this. There are a lot of arguments being tossed back and forth. Some of them have to do with violating individual rights. Most of the arguments we hear have to do with whether he actually has the power. But I think it's fairly clear that he does have the power. In our country, we divide authority up between the states and the federal government, part of our federal system. And we usually think of the states as being the ones that have the police power, you know, to protect the health and welfare of people. But the federal government has other powers, including the commerce power, that give it the authority to regulate aspects of the country that are related to interstate commerce. And I think there's no question that what we're dealing with here, the COVID and companies with more than 100 employees, certainly affect interstate commerce and give Congress, the federal government, the authority to regulate aspects of that.
All right, Bill, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Got to check traffic and weather together. Constitutional law professor Bill Dunlop, the Law School of Quinnipiac University, filling us in here. More with Bill straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, then back with more on WICC. And we continue to talk about some suggestions or mandates alluded to last week by President Joe Biden trying to pick up the vaccination rates here in the state. The president, obviously, or in the country, rather, as well. The president, obviously, a little exacerbated that the completely vaccinated number is still hovering in the mid-50s. He wants to get that up to the 70s or higher. So last week, he said that all federal workers, all federal contractors had a mandatory vaccination idea in his head to do this. There have been also a push by the president as well to push private employers to do this to some extent as well. Quinnipiac University constitutional law professor Bill Dunlap continues with us for a few minutes. Bill, I've seen this particular case cited in numerous articles, numerous reference points, a Supreme Court case from back in 1905, I think it was, Jacobson v. Massachusetts. I see that being cited by a lot of people about vaccinations and authority. What's the importance of that case?
Well, it stands for the general principle that government in the United States can mandate vaccinations in the face of epidemics like this. It doesn't go directly to this problem, though, because that was a state agency, mm-hmm. or actually a local agency, that was requiring the vaccination that Jacobson was objecting to. So while it does show that people can be ordered to vaccinate, it just doesn't show that the federal government can order it. But I think that the federal government can order it, as I was saying before the break. So now the really big question is, just because the federal government can do it does not mean the president can do it on his own. And that's where a lot of the criticism is coming from. The president can do only what's authorized in the Constitution or by statute. But I think that Congress has authorized him by statute to do this. In the Occupation and Safety Health Act of 1970, where it gives the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Agency, mm-hmm. the authority to impose regulations to protect workers, people in the workplace, from health and safety risks. And it specifically mentions to protect them from substances in the air or substances in the workplace that could threaten them. And I think it could easily be determined that the COVID problem meets that standard.
So again, Bill, the president would cite his authority under that measure you mentioned and say, hey, I don't have to wrench this through Congress. OSHA is allowed to do this. And I read this bill extensively over the weekend, that this comes under the umbrella of workplace safety.
That's exactly right. OSHA is designed to promote or to guarantee workplace safety. And I think an argument could be made that if it did not do this, it would be shirking its responsibilities.
So, Bill, if you were acting as counsel right now as we speak for an organization, an individual citizen, maybe even some of these federal employee unions who apparently are not completely on board with this bill, what would be an argument you think the other side would use if they filed, say, a federal level suit against this? What do you think they would try and argue?
I think the best argument would probably be that it has not been proven yet that, let me back up there for a second.
Sure.
When OSHA imposes these standards on companies, there's a very time-consuming, detailed process that they have to go through. And on average, it takes between 7 and 8 years to get a regulation approved. We clearly don't have time for that with this particular pandemic. And so the president has ordered OSHA, or ordered the Department of Labor, to issue an emergency temporary standard, which can be put through very, very quickly. It's good only for 6 months. And the opponents of this might be able to argue that this does not really meet the standards necessary for an emergency temporary standard. I think it does. I think the death of 650,000 people around the country in the past year or so constitutes an emergency. But the question of what is an emergency is something that can be examined by the courts.
And Bill,
an interesting twist on this, though, is that the conservative justices who tend to dominate the Supreme Court and the appellate courts these days are the ones who tend to say these are not judicial questions. We should defer to the administration.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that is a core conservative principle that, you can't really get in and monkey with this And Bill, you kind of led into my next question. If that were the argument and they went to file that on a federal level, you'd have to have a judge correct or a panel of somebody on some circuit and of judges who would want to even get involved in this, right? I mean, a judge could say, hey, I'm not going to hear this case, correct?
Well, yeah, this will actually be going directly into an appellate court.
Okay.
Because it's a decision coming out of the administrative agency, the agencies that are involved here, it will not go to a federal district court where the opponents could sort of shop around and look for a judge who's already been harsh on pandemic standards. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to begin at a relatively high level. And they're not really going to have a lot of choice. I think the appellate court that hears this, if in fact that happens, is going to have to take it very seriously and come to a decision one way or the other.
As always, we thank you, Quinnipiac University constitutional law expert and professor Bill Dunlap, for trying to straighten this all out for us. Bill, thank you again. We appreciate the time, and we'll talk down the road, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
All right, thanks. So there you go, folks. It really is an OSHA issue, as Bill described. Yeah, there's a legal proceeding. There are several legal proceedings about this, but it is an Occupational Safety and Health Administration issue. And does the act, does the law that formed OSHA and its connection to the executive branch and an aspect of that law that allows it to act on emergencies, does that act as the fulcrum here? Bill, thank you. We're going to put that in the podcast so you can listen to it or send it to whomever you'd like. We'll get back to open phones later in the hour to finish up the show. And when we do that, we'll be doing that, of course, at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I got information on a really interesting book, I thought, and I wanted to have the author on because these are the people or at least some of the people that were considered frontline workers but really didn't receive the admiration, the glory, the laudatory things said about them that we heard about doctors and nurses and CNAs and RNAs and all that, and police and firefighters during the height of the pandemic. Grocery store workers. Name of the book is Life on the Grocery Line, A Frontline Experience in a Global Pandemic. You can pick it up in paperback or the Kindle edition at Amazon.com. And the author, Adam Cott, is with us. Adam, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you today?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
What made you do this? Now, I understand you, from what the material says here, I have you took a job in a grocery store at the outset of the pandemic. And what happened? You just started noticing this stuff and wanting to put this down. Take us through that process.
Well, so yeah, I took like a bit of a sabbatical, a self-imposed sabbatical from my corporate life and to work on a different novel. And once late January came, I didn't have enough money, so I needed to go to find a job. So I decided to work in a grocery store. And I thought it'd be just a fun job that, you know, I could talk to people.
Sure.
And I could flirt with girls and joke around. And
So wait a minute, hold on. Was this part of this about picking up chicks? Is that what you're telling me here?
No.
Okay. Okay, but it was a nice thought, though. But go ahead.
Yeah, it was going to be a fun, easy job.
Sure,
that, like,
sure.
I could just work on writing a different book.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
Then soon enough, you know, like the pandemic hit the states, and I live in Colorado, so it got to my state, and, you know, schools closed down, everything changed, and it turned into this very strange situation where I was, like, basically these people's like a therapist of some sort, and I had to go to work.
Yeah.
Everyone's scared. Everyone's doom scrolling on Twitter. You don't know what's going on. You think the cat might give you coronavirus, all these different things. And the best way for me to deal with anything in my life is to write about it.
Okay.
So I started a blog. to lifeonthegroceryline.com.
Yeah.
And just shared my stories, but kind of fictionalized them. And so I turned like a lot of those stories into a narrative that follows Daniel as a new cashier at a high-end grocery store the first week of the pandemic.
You know, and Adam, I was thinking about all you guys and gals doing this because I kept reminding people on this show, hey, even at the worst of the pandemic, Adam, you know, gas stations were still open, banks were still open, and I said, you know, your food stores are still open. There's somebody working there. We can't shut down the food stores. People have to eat. So kudos to you guys and gals that were doing that. But could you see, I guess you could because you wrote the book, a perceptible or perceivable tension or anxiety in people in the store you were at that you and your coworkers were dealing with on a daily basis?
Oh, yeah. It definitely, like, it bubbled up. Seemingly, it felt like from nowhere. And it felt like every day you had something new, like you had to wear a mask. You had to wipe down the register, and they wanted you to wipe down groceries. And, like, we'd eventually have to be checked for our temperature going in, stuff like that. So, and there was a line outside, so they'd limit the amount of people that could come in.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, snowy in the Rockies, or spring in the Rockies is pretty snowy. So
yeah.
People were miserable and intense. And, you know, and they became so isolated that, like, the only person besides the family to talk to was cashiers or grocery store employees.
Wow.
So you had a real weird tension for a job that seems so, I don't know, kind of like it was an in-between job for me. So.
Wow. Adam, hang on. I want to get more into that, into what the customers and patrons were like. Adam McCott is the author. The book is called Life on the Grocery Line, A Frontline Experience in a Global Pandemic. He tells the stories through a character there, but it's all stuff that he saw. We'll talk about more of that with Adam Cott. Straight ahead, first, traffic and weather together right here. It's a Tuesday at WICC. A couple of more minutes here. The name of the book, Life on the Grocery Line, Frontline Experience in a Global Pandemic. Available paperback or softback or Kindle edition on Amazon.com. The author, Adam Cott, who, to make a little extra money between gigs, he went to work in a Colorado grocery store and started seeing this stuff. Adam, before the break, you mentioned that, what, you and your coworkers there were times where you had to be, like, just people to talk to, like counselors, like therapists. Talk about that. Would people just start, like, venting or just, like, just want to get stuff off their chest? What was that like?
Yeah, especially when the school shut down, that's when I noticed it the most. You know, a lot of very concerned parents, people that didn't really know what to do. So I worked in a very high-end grocery store in a very nice, like, fancy neighborhood in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of people that I felt like they hadn't really seen, like, or worried about anything in a long time. And there was a lot of emotional, like, outbursts, I guess you could say.
Wow.
But there was some crying here and there. You know, everyone was dealing with things, especially at the beginning when people were hoarding stuff and the shelves were empty and it looked very, like, dystopian or something. It was scary and people were scared. And, you know, I didn't mind that. I actually liked being there for people, even for a moment. If they were being nice, if they were being mean, then I wasn't exactly sure
so,
to do it.
So would they just start, like, just talking to you, like, casual conversation, like, hey, can you believe this? And then that led to, like, pouring out of their souls there? Were they freaking out when they couldn't find, you mentioned that time when the shelves were bare. I guess this is about the time that, you know, toilet paper became, like, you know, more wanted than Bitcoin. I mean, remember that when
yeah,
like, people were hoarding toilet paper? So this was around that time then, you're saying?
Yes, exactly. Like, the people were, I mean, it always start off casual. And
yeah,
if I, and this is kind of before we had plexiglass, so I might have had masks. And, you know, you'd be talking about things and they're concerned about what are they going to do or, like, how long is this going to, you know, go on, because we thought, you know, with 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and then, You know, it's, but no one really knew how long the idea of lockdown would go. We ran out of yeast, canned food, really even the produce section was super empty.
Wow.
Pretty much the, like anything except for, I mean, dairy kind of was the only thing left, I felt like, or some oddball stuff. But man, so much of the food was gone and people were panicked. You know, they were like, how am I going to feed my family too? Like, I can't get anything. I'm late to the grocery store or whatever.
And that's a couple of seconds ago, that's pretty wild stuff, Adam, when you said that here you were in kind of this Tony area outside Denver at one of these high-end niche grocery stores. And it hit me when you said most of these were people who never really, I mean, we don't know to what extent, but it didn't seem like they were dealing with any adversity usually.
Yes. Yeah. And this was a major thing that was affecting everyone, kind of blindsided everyone too. I think the odd thing is that it didn't really change like a lot of buying habits. I mean, you can't freeze produce.
No.
You can't freeze dairy. You like the meat was completely destroyed. Basically, like everyone ripped through in those first like 2 weeks probably.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was scary even for people that had never really probably been scared, or at least in a very long time.
I also read, Adam, that comfort foods went like crazy. I mean, I was doing this show and reading stories like once or twice a week where like, what was it, like Kraft couldn't make enough macaroni and cheese. People were saying like, you know, screw my diet. If we're going to die, I want mac and cheese. Did you see the comfort foods flying out of there, the snacks and all that?
I don't remember specifically the comfort foods, but like the, I mean, pasta was gone instantly.
Yeah.
Pasta lasts a long time, you know, like in yeast and things like that. Our seafood even got kind of ravaged. And people, I think at first, because they thought since it was just going to be 2 weeks, that they would, like, ball out a little bit. And, like, you saw crab legs and stuff like that go through. people wanting to, you know, they're locked at home. We might as well make the most of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that wore on, and people got really sick of it pretty quick.
Wow. So what you're saying is even crab legs and fine seafood can get boring. Is that what you're telling me?
I guess so for those folks.
Oh, Adam, this was great. And what a great idea. You tell it through a character there in the store, Daniel. Once again, folks, the name of the book, Life on the Grocery Line, A Frontline Experience in a Global Pandemic. You can get it electronically for your Kindle or a softback edition paperback. The author, Adam Cott, joined us. Adam, thanks so much, man. This was a great idea. I'm definitely going to download this and check it out. Be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Adam Cott there. Man, how about that, huh?